You can tell the story is setting up for what is going to be a terrible encounter between an indifferent judge and a worthless widow. She's never going to get a fair hearing, is she? Let alone a just verdict at the end of it. And the storyteller, Jesus, portrays these two characters in just about the most extreme way possible. Then we arrive at the unequal meeting in court. The widow wishes to sue her neighbor, as we've heard, but she's blocked from doing so. She tries again. The judge blocks her again. Now, we'd understand if she were feeling pretty discouraged by this point. We would understand if she went away. No doubt the judge thought, as she left court, well, that's the last we're going to see of her. But no, says the text. Verse 3, she keeps coming back to court. She keeps coming back to confront the judge, more demanding than before, more insistent, more sharp. She keeps asking, verse 3, grant me the justice to which I am entitled. You can imagine the reaction of the court when this widow turns up yet again. She's not very well dressed. She's not very eloquent. She can't afford a solicitor, so she represents herself, poorly, no doubt. The judge is exasperated. The widow should have been sufficiently discouraged by now to stop coming, but she has nowhere else to go. And she's convinced that she is in the right, so she keeps coming back. She makes no new arguments, but rather simply over and over again says, give me justice. And finally, after the umpteenth court appearance, the judge, as we heard, is exhausted. He is weary of her. She's not taken any hints from his constant indifference. She just won't go away. In order to get rid of her, the judge gives her finally what she wants. He grants her justice against her neighbor, and she wins the case, as one of the commentators, Walter Brueggemann, puts it, because she is a determined, relentless nag. And the reason for her nagging is that she had hope. Hope not so much in the judge, of course, but in the rightness of her claim. And so she wins by not giving in. Now remember, this is a parable about prayer. So Jesus interprets it and comments on it. And he says to us, notice what happens to the unjust judge. He's forced to give justice, not out of any desire or passion or commitment, but in order to get a little peace and quiet. And then, Jesus says, in a daring maneuver, you know, prayer to God is like that. We must remember, we're not hearing a lecture in systematic theology. We are hearing a playful rabbinic story. But it's pretty surprising. It's a pretty shocking tale to come out of Jesus' mouth, nonetheless. I think we can be a little too romantic about prayer, thinking it's a nice thing to do between friends. Or we can at times be a little cynical about prayer, feeling that, well, nothing really happens anyway. We're just kind of going through the motions. But both romanticism and cynicism miss the point. Let's notice three things about the story and about Jesus' comments on it. First of all, the woman is filled with hope. She's filled with hope. She was not ever going to give up or give in. She had hope because she knew that what she was asking for was legitimate. She had hope because she believed that things could and would and must change. She had hope that the judge was going to finally rule in her favor, whether he liked her or not, because her case was compelling. Prayer depends on that kind of hope, doesn't it? That God has the power to change things and to create newness. And the second thing to notice about this story, this playful rabbinic story, is that the subject matter of prayer is justice. This word justice runs throughout the whole text. In the story, the woman says in verse 3, grant me justice. The judge, exhausted, finally says in verse 5, I will see that she gets justice. And Jesus, in his comments, verses 7 and 8, says, God will bring about justice. He will see that they get justice quickly. Justice is the right subject matter for prayer, as this story shows with the image of a court and a judge. But we would do well just to linger a moment on this word justice. It's often misunderstood, and we think of justice in terms of people getting what they deserve according to what they have done. So, you know, bad people should be punished, lazy people should starve, you know, that kind of thing. But that's not what the Bible means by justice. When all the way through the Bible we read about this word, justice, it means that all people, because they've been created in God's image, because they're part of the community, they're entitled to all that is needed for dignity and peace and freedom and health and joy and security. And caring, nagging people do not come before God with frivolous, selfish requests in their prayers. Rather, the subject of our prayer should be to urge God to give justice, which means dignity for children and safety for families and homes for the homeless and schools for all the learners and health care for the poor and food for the needy and respect for the abused and compassion for the hurting and rest for the weary and access for the disabled, a family for the lonely, a community for the isolated, hope for the hopeless. These are some of the things that are bound up in the biblical sense of justice. The Bible imagines that God will finally not let the world linger in inequity and injustice. And as a church, we gather to pray sometimes for ourselves and for our own needs. But, you know, sometimes we're kind of comfortable in our churches and we don't have any desperate overriding needs. And so we go to court on behalf of others and lift up their cause for justice. And we do that because Jesus tells us, pray always, pray to the judge for justice. So nagging prayers for justice are in fact acts of hope. The naggers are filled with hope that justice can be done, that God will listen, that the world will be changed, and the widow will be honored. And then Jesus ends this lesson on prayer with the haunting unanswered question, when the Son of Man comes, verse 8, that final accounting of God, will he find faith on this earth? So that's the third thing we can take away from this story and Jesus' comments on it, that underneath the hope and the justice and the nagging, there is faith. There is faith that this is God's world and that God will listen and that the world will be changed. In our secularized world, we lose that faith and we lose heart. And we end up feeling despair, perhaps not us, but people around us. They feel despair, that the problems are insoluble, that the world is so skewed that finally nothing can be changed. That is the attitude, I think, of many of our contemporaries who have given up on the faithfulness of God and even the reality of God. And there's no middle ground either. We're like the widow, believing and hoping and nagging for justice, or, says Jesus, we lose heart. And when we lose heart, we stop nagging and we stop caring and we stop hoping and we stop trusting and we settle into complacency and docility and passivity. And we tell ourselves that the world will not change and that the world cannot change. And we accept the problems of inequity and injustice, the homelessness, the poverty, the isolation, the hopelessness and all the rest of it. We accept them as permanent, intransient realities. But we, my friends, we, the people of God, we, by God's grace, we're believers, are we not? We are hopers. And yes, we're even naggers for justice. So let us not be resigned about ourselves. Let's not be resigned about our family members. Let's not be resigned about the problems in our town or the injustice in our world. Jesus urges us through this curious story, do not lose heart. Care endlessly, relentlessly, passionately. Pray always. That's his message. Rosemary and I are very grateful to you for your prayers for us. That's been 25 years now since we left this church to go to France initially and through different roles that we've had. And we're grateful for all your support in its different ways, so faithful over that time. We're back in France full-time now since September, after 16 years in the regional role. And it might just be worth pausing to ask the question, why is it that BMS works in France? BMS has a commitment, you know, to work with the world's most marginalized peoples and most fragile states. Those are two of the three focuses, or foci, I don't know the plural. But there is a third focus, and that's to work with the world's least evangelized communities. And it's because of this third focus that BMS works in France. You know, I think it's the only economically developed country in which BMS still works, and that's because of the spiritual needs there. France's fierce secularism is part of the country's identity and very much integral to the country's history. And today, the secularism in France is quite articulate and determined, with the population defending itself against religion and religious people. Secularism, when it's understood correctly, is not an alternative to religion. It is like a neutral framework in which the religious and the non-religious can function together. It's almost like a guarantee of the freedom of religions in reality. But in France, you regularly hear the argument, particularly at times of social unrest, you know, we're a secular country, we ought to be banning these religions that are such a cause of trouble and problems. And I think that this atmosphere of suspicion and concern has grown up in France since the 1980s, because that was the decade when Islam really started to develop and become a bigger presence in France. But in addition to the aggressive secularism, France is also the world's fourth most atheistic population, after China, Japan, and the Czech Republic. In fact, I was reading an article recently here in the UK, at least I was in France, reading online an article from the Independent newspaper, and they were reminding the readers that more than 20% of the French population described themselves as convinced atheists. And then we were talking about Islam. Across Europe, the percentage of people from a Muslim background is generally 5%, if it's the whole of Europe you're looking at. But within France, that figure is 12.5%. France also has the largest number of converts to Islam. And so this big Muslim presence clearly has an impact on life and on ministry in France as well. When it comes to the number of Christian believers, the proportions are very different from here in the UK, even though we have more or less the same population. I reckon there are 2,800, something like that, Baptist churches in the UK. Of course, at the end of his presidential year, Dave will be able to recite them all in alphabetical order and just clarify whether I've got that figure right or not. But I am very clear on the French figure, where it's just 174. Very, very different, even though the populations are the same. And it's not a quirk to do with Baptists. If you take all the Protestant evangelicals together in France, the number of their congregations you can see there is 2,263. So these are some of the reasons why BMS is staying on in this one last economically developed country. It's because of these spiritual needs. We're glad that BMS is doing that and very happy to be a part of that work. So since September then, our role has been to give a national lead amongst French Baptists in the area of church planting, new communities, but also in trying to build up communities that are not new, but that have become small for one reason or another and could do with that help. Church planting has always been in the DNA, really, of the French Baptist Federation. It was only 15 years after they were formed that they created the equivalent of Home Mission. That's me with all the church planters in January. I don't know why I'm the only one not wearing a coat, but anyway, maybe it's my Scottish hardy side coming through. But there we are. And as I say, that from the very beginning, they've been concerned with planting new churches and sharing faith. And this team that we lead now has been the vehicle through which over 40% of the current French Baptist churches have come into being. So you can imagine, we're excited to be taking up this role and to be leading this team. At the moment, we're accompanying about 15 church plants around the country and another 5 of these smaller churches that are trying to perhaps be more outward looking and build up. Very much smaller proportions than here in the UK. But again, that's just the nature of the ministry in France. And then Rosemary and I are involved in local ministry in both the expressions of ministry that this team is trying to help with on a national level. So we're involved in a church plant just next to where we live in a place called Gif-sur-Yvette. We've teamed up with another BMS worker, the lady on the right, Christine Kling, who is a pastor, and we're working with her in that town. Very unusually, after what I've just told you about France, the town planners who were building this new town in the 70s decided to include an ecumenical center. Beautiful, isn't it? And we share that with a Catholic congregation and an Anglican congregation. We tend to meet in one of the side rooms, the side halls, but if we wish to, we can also meet in the sanctuary, and we do that sometimes. We gather for worship each weekend, either on a Sunday morning or a Saturday evening. But to be honest, most of the activity is midweek contact groups and friendship groups in homes. You're trying to make connections with the community. We do sometimes organize a larger event. We have the help from the church in Massey. Some of you will know that name, the church we used to be at, which is just next door, and they'll come and help us put on a bigger event, maybe to create some more publicity and interest in the town. We did so at Christmas, for example. You might recognize that oboe player in the inset in the top left. But most of our activity is small scale. It's about sharing food and friendship and exploratory Bible studies and talking around a theme and that sort of thing. The work is progressing bit by bit, but it's going to be slow. I think that's the nature of ministry in France. It will take time. It will require perseverance. That's just coming to the end of our first year in this church plant. Just as an example, a couple of people who've come along since September, the lady on the left, Adela, with her children, she has some kind of vague Christian background, but she hadn't really had any active faith or been part of any community for a long time. And I think it's the fact of raising her children now is making her think she needs to address this question of faith as well. And so she saw us online and she's come and joined us. And then the girl on the right, Leah, very different, a 21-year-old. It was one of the times I was leading the gathering. She just came in and said, "Hello, I'm a new Christian. I came to faith when I was studying abroad in Switzerland. Now I'm back home. I'm looking for a church. I found you online." And so, these are the folks that we're working with, and it's a pleasure to be part of their faith journey. We're hoping others, of course, will join them. That's what we're doing 3 weeks of the month. On the fourth week of the month, we're living in Brittany. And we're working with these two congregations in Morley and Roscoff. They're not new at all. They're very old, but they have become quite small. And as I say, we're trying to help them to be a little more outward looking and to grow and to develop. Like in the church plant locally, we sometimes put on a bigger event at Christmas time, or currently there's an exhibition about Martin Luther King. But mainly, the work there too is about small groups. It's about meeting together. It's about eating and talking and getting to know folks. And that's the way we're proceeding. You might be interested to learn that it's not a new idea to send BMS mission workers to Brittany. In fact, there are predecessors. John and Elizabeth Jenkins went from Wales back in 1835. And then their son, Alfred, would become the pastor of the church in Morley and would marry a local baker's daughter, Anne. So we were found that very, very moving, in fact, to realize that we were connected in some way with the very beginning of BMS work all those years ago. And we came across a letter from the son and his wife, from Alfred and Anne, a letter that they were describing their ministry back to their supporters from all those years ago. And this is what they said. They said, "The work is very difficult, that is indisputable. It demands a thorough knowledge of the local language and mentality and a great deal of patience, faith, and love on the part of the mission personnel. But the goal is worth it." So across more than a century, I think Rosemary and I would say a big amen to Alfred and Anne Jenkins. And we would, of course, be grateful for your prayers as we continue to work with these two small congregations in the coming year, 1 week a month, as well as church planting locally, 3 weeks in the month with Christine, and then overall giving a lead on the national scale to do with all the church planting program and the trying to revitalize these smaller congregations. As I close, let me just go back with you to the story that Jesus told of the widow and the judge. again, in conclusion or to sum up, we're reminded that prayer is not just for well-brought-up children on their way to bed in the evening. And neither is prayer simply a neurotic for neurotic people who are sadly just have become too religious. On the contrary, prayer is the core action by which we keep the faith. Prayer is the action by which we hope for the world, by which we keep this matter of justice before God and before ourselves. To pray always means to care always about inequality and inequity, to hope always for justice, and to trust always in the power of God. So as Jesus encourages us, let us not lose heart, but rather let us pray always. Can I invite you to a moment of reflection and prayer as we close?